Hello and welcome to the August 2012 edition of the Internet Storm Center's monthly threat update. My name is Johannes Ulrich here in Jacksonville, Florida, again as usual. Actually, just a thunderstorm and some rain moving down outside here. So if you hear some rumbling in the background, that's probably due to the rain. As most of you are familiar with the platform, if you're not familiar with it, the main feature you have to be aware of is the chat window. You see it on the left-hand side. Use it if you have any questions, problems, concerns. Just type in the chat window. You should be able just to address the room. Everybody will see it. If I don't respond, it may be because I'm not looking at the chat window. Just click the raise hand icon, very left-hand side of the screen, sort of between the list of users and the chat window. This will just ring a bell, so I'll be aware that someone asked a question. They'll record this, and it will be available as an archive within a couple of hours. We may also publish it, just the audio part, as a podcast at some later point, maybe tomorrow, maybe on Friday. Well, with that, let me get started here. And first, I want to acknowledge our sponsor, Core Security Technologies. They're sort of paying for this, and they don't even ask to speak. So I got the whole 45 minutes to an hour here to talk about what I want to talk. And well, what am I going to talk about today? Most of the time with these monthly threat updates, the way we have them scheduled is we have them scheduled at the second Wednesday of the month. So what that means is that we are typically the day after Microsoft's patch Tuesday. Now, this month is one of these rare occasions where the month actually starts on a Wednesday, so the second Tuesday will be next Tuesday, and we got the webcast today just sort of not for us, and I usually use that for some special topics. So what I picked here is DNS. We have talked about DNS and some of the current threats and issues with DNS before here on this webcast, but I want to take the time to essentially discuss as much about DNS as I can within an hour. I was planning a little bit more, but then when I hit like 40 slides, I figured that's probably about as much as I can cover within the hour we have here. And well, you know, maybe there will be a follow-up or so we can do at some other point with the remaining topics. So anyway, here's the brief outline that we have. I first want to introduce the DNS protocol a little bit, sort of at a bits and bytes level, to show you how things are encoded in DNS, in particular host names. And then for each one of these sections, I sort of have a security feature, like here with pointers, for example. That's one feature, how host names are encoded that matters, for example, for IDSs. Then DNS architecture, authoritative versus recursive servers. We'll talk about reflective attacks here as a security issue. EDNS 0 that makes this reflective attack more efficient, so to speak. And then we got DNS Sec. Now, DNS Sec is, of course, a security feature. We'll spend a little bit of time on that. But it's part of the reason why we need EDNS 0 is DNS Sec. Then alternatives to DNSSEC, or, well, wouldn't really call it alternative, but I'll get to that when we talk about the feature. OpenDNS recently introduced something called DNSCrypt, so I'll talk a little bit about that. And then something called Cirex 20 encoding, or sort of upper-lowercase encoding of host names as a little bit an alternative to DNSSEC. That's something we have talked about before in prior webcasts, but never sort of really explained it in context. So anyway, what about the DNS protocol? Here we have our standard DNS packet. And the first thing to understand about DNS is that when you look at the packet itself, there isn't really a fundamental difference between a query and a response. Actually, any query may include responses. Any response typically includes the query that it responds to, but whether or not it's a query, well, that's what these flags will tell you. And other important part, another important security feature is the query ID. The query ID actually originally was meant to be incremented with each query. And the main reason for the query ID is if I'm sending out multiple queries to the same name server, I have to have a way to distinguish the responses that come back so I know which response belongs to what query I send out. And that's what this query ID is about. Now, it has become a security feature, but the problem is we really don't have a lot of space here. We have 2 bytes, so essentially 65,000 different query IDs. And that's sort of one of the weaknesses here when it comes to DNS security, that there is no real like session ID here. The query ID is really a lame excuse for a session ID. Just I have here one user that says they are, he's not getting any audio. Anybody else having audio issues? Or let's ask the question differently. If you could just press the little smiley face if you do get audio and if the audio quality is okay, and if you could click the frowny face if you don't get audio. Okay, looks like that got fixed. So everybody should have audio at this point. So if you do have problems, again, just use the chat window in case it sort of stutters or something like that. Like I said, I have just a big thunderstorm moving through outside, and sometimes internet connection can have issues. Not sure if you just heard that thunder that's rumbling here right now. Anyway, so that's the basic protocol. Then we have the number of questions, number of answers, authority records, additional records. Like I mentioned, queries and responses may include any of them. And then we have the respective questions, answers, authority records, and additional records. Now the question is essentially what they're asking. The answers is the answer to those questions if this packet happens to include them. And then the authority records are essentially name servers that are related to the answer. Additional records, again, name servers related, additional records, additional information related to the authority records or the answers. One reason we need additional records is for name server IP addresses. Authority records or name servers are host names. So if you're looking up the host name or the IP address for www.sans.org, you may get back as an authority record, well, ns.sans.org is responsible for sans.org. But how do I find out what's the IP address for ns.sans.org? Well, I have to ask ns.sans.org. So to solve that problem, we have additional records. But additional records really can contain anything. So typically, yes, it is the A records or the quad A records, so the IPv4 and IPv6 address of the record that we are going to use. But they could really include other A records, other NS records, whatever the responder would like to add here. Just 1 second here for, okay. Now, really important here are these flags and codes. It's 2 bytes, and they really span those 2 bytes. Now, the first bit here tells us whether this is a query and a response. And like I said, this is the one part that tells us whether or not it's a query response. The rest of the packet really may look the same. Then we have an opcode that tells us more about the packet. So for example, is this normal query, an incremental, an inverse query, whether this is of a status query. We want to notify something that one DNS server would send to another DNS server to tell that DNS server, hey, my zone just got modified and I see that you are another name server for this zone. So here's an upgrade date for the zone. Yeah, so this is notify and update where they are used. AA is if this is an authoritative answer, so if the name server that's actually responding here is authoritative for the zone. Truncated, we'll get to that in a bit, but just as a quick summary, UDP replies in DNS can only be 512 bytes. If they're longer, then we have to tell the recipient that there is actually more data here, and that's when they send the truncate flag. Recursion desired and recursion available, that tells the, that should be RA, not TA. Recursion desired, I send a query out to a name server and tell the name server, hey, resolve this for me and give me the final response. Recursion available, that's something the name server sends back telling me, hey, if you want, I can do all the work for you and go to all these other name servers that may need to be queried here. So this is something that's usually being offered by a recursive name server. Recursion desired is something your client would set. We'll get back to these server flags in a second, but then if there's a response, we also have a number of response codes. I only listed the sort of important ones here. Zero, no error, that's of course what you would like to see. Format error means that your query was formatted badly. I see this from name servers that are under high load too. So if a name server has problems keeping up with it, I sometimes see them send format errors back. Server failure just means something is messed up with the server. An X domain means that record doesn't exist, so it means there is no answer. And then you have refuse, which means there is an answer, there may be an answer, but you're not allowed to see it. Okay, now these zero flags, originally were just defined as zero, but then later when DNSSEC was introduced, two of these flags are now defined. The first flag, AD here, is set whenever the name server checked whether or not the DNSSEC validates correctly. So if you trust the name server that responds with the AD flag set, it means you don't have to check it, it's already checked. Checking disable is something that you would send in a request. You send out a request, you don't trust the name server that you send this to. You say, hey, check disabled, don't bother doing the DNSSEC check because I'm not going to trust you anyway. Now, the queries themselves, the way they're encoded is that they start out with the query name, essentially what do we try to look up. So for example, that would be the host name. Then what type of record we're looking for, like A for an IPv4 address, Quad A for an IPv6 address, NS for a name server, then DNS signatures. There are many, many others. These are just important ones. And then the class, but really the only important one here is the Internet class. Chaos is something that Bind does, and it's really used for internal queries to look up the version, for example, of Bind, but something you shouldn't really see in normal traffic. Now, responses, the encoding for response is very similar. Starts out with a name, a type, and a class of the response. But then we also have a time to live. How long is this response valid for? The length of the response. And then, of course, whatever data is associated with it. Now, one thing you already see is there's a lot of variable length data fields, and that's somewhat a pain with DNS and, for example, parsing DNS or pattern matching for DNS, because a lot of it really depends on the data that came before it. So that makes it kind of difficult to actually set up an IDS signature, for example. Now, each individual string in DNS is also sort of broken down to into different labels. So here's, for example, isc.sans.edu encoded the way DNS encodes it. It always starts with the length of the next label, here three, then our label, so each label is a part of the host name, ISC, then 04, because the next label here is 4 bytes long, 03, and then EDU, and then finally 0 to end that particular name. Now, each label can only be 63 bytes in length. And that's not obvious at first because it looks like they have one byte for each label, which would indicate you have 255 bytes for each label. However, the first two bits of this length field have a special meaning. And this is where this gets a little bit more interesting. They're used for pointers. Whenever the name, is the first two bits of the length field are both set, which means you would have C or Charlie or something like that, then this length field is actually no length field at all. It is a pointer to where the string continues. The reason this is done is for compression. Like, for example, my response includes ns.sans.edu, isc.sans.edu, and ww.sans.edu. And that's quite common. You have the domain name shows up multiple times in response. So I can now compress it by only showing the full name, here once, and then the other names, like isc.sans.edu, they just have ISC and then a pointer to the first occurrence of sans.edu. Same for www.sans.edu. So this compresses DNS. But this can also be used for evil. I can make it harder for an IDS to actually pick out what is the host name. Because if I want to look for all queries that are including isc.sans.edu, I could just look for this particular string of bytes. Well, but there are other ways to encode it. For example, here I first have this labeled edu, and then I have isc.sans, but then a pointer pointing to edu, which preceded isc.sans. So this way now the label or the string actually looks different. And this makes it necessary that you, for example, need preprocessors for DNS that will actually decode these labels first. Now, the other thing I already mentioned kind of is that there are two different kinds of name servers, authoritative and recursive name servers. An authoritative name server knows authoritative answers for particular zones. So, for example, we do have a couple name servers that are listed as authoritative for sans.org. The recursive name server, on the other hand, is a name server that you use to actually resolve arbitrary names. So, via DHCP or whatever mechanisms you set up, you are being assigned a recursive name server, and any DNS queries that you may have are being sent to that recursive name server. It's important to keep those two name servers separate. Main reason for that is reflective denial of service attacks. Essentially, the authoritative name server will only answer if the query is related to a zone it's authoritative for. However, it will accept queries from anybody. The recursive name server sort of works the other way around. The recursive name server doesn't worry what you ask it, and it will go out to other name servers to find the answer. But it will only answer if it's correctly set up for queries that come from your internal network. So the public at large shouldn't be able to use your recursive name server. So your recursive name servers only will answer queries that come from a trusted network. And the reason you need this is for these nasty amplification attacks. And this is why they work. Here I have a simple any query forsans.org. The length of this query is 26 bytes. In response, I get 506 bytes in this example. It varies a little bit. You can try it yourself and see what the size is for you, but it's sort of around it. It may even be larger than that. Now, the trick here is if someone spoofs that query, then the spoofed IP address will receive the full response. So in this case, the attacker is able to amplify the attack by a factor of 20. And the victim in this case would be flooded with these replies, and it would have a hard time filtering out the replies that are being sent to it based on queries it sent out, or just based on spoofed queries that others sent. So this is the overall trick here. The attacker is spoofing these queries, and then these large replies are flooding the poor victim. And the number one way this is abused is if your recursive name server accepts queries from anybody. However, we also have seen some of these tools that are now only asking you queries for zones you are responsible for, and there isn't really a great way to turn this off on your DNS server. The only thing you can do in this case is that you can rate limit these queries, particularly any queries are frequently used because they tend to have large responses. Very recently, some patches for Bind got published. I'm not sure, I don't think they're actually part of the sort of most recent version of Bind yet, that allow you to rate limit these queries within Bind's configuration itself. If you can't do it within your DNS server, then of course you have to do it at the firewall. Now there was a question here, how does packet size impact this amplification? Well, good question, and we'll get to this in a second with eDNS 0. But by default, old style DNS servers, the largest response they'll send back is 512 bytes. And that's why they like these anyqueries, because they typically are just around 500 bytes, so they get the biggest bang for the buck here. One defense for the victim here is that they block all UDP 53 queries. Now, what they do then in this case is they just send empty truncated responses back, telling the source, hey, come back via TCP. If the query was spoofed, then of course that response goes nowhere and the victim will never come back via TCP. So that's sort of like Cisco sells a denial of service appliance that implements that particular defense. But then what about packet sizes? So by default, DNS only allows 512 bytes to be sent via UDP. However, in particular, if you're talking about DNSSEC later, that's not really sufficient. DNSSEC replies with all these keys and such are frequently a lot larger than 512 bytes. And if the response doesn't fit into 512 bytes, then the client has to come back via TCP. So there's sort of a catch-22 here. The reason it's limited to 512 bytes is because 512 bytes is never fragmented. The minimum MTUs you should see is like 570 bytes, so that's how they pick the 512 bytes. But most hosts these days are able to receive more than 512 bytes without fragmentation. Like, you know, 1500 bytes are the most common MTU out there for Ethernet. In order to accommodate this, in order to avoid the overhead of having come back via TCP, eDNS 0 was invented. And eDNS 0 essentially allows the client, as part of the query, to specify what is the largest response the client is willing to accept via UDP. The server may still use a smaller response size and may still do truncation. So that's still an option. but at least the server now has the option to send the entire response back. Now, the way it is encoded, we hadn't really had an option field in the header, if you sort of remember earlier. So there is a special resource record. It's just sent as an additional record. And if a resource record has this option type, the only option that's defined right now is option type 0. That's why it's called EDNS 0. And with that, we just basically tell the server, hey, this is the maximum size we're willing to accept. This can be pretty much anything. Very common is 4 kilobytes. They're 4,096 bytes. The reason they picked that is because that's big enough for most DNSSEC responses. However, that also means that now the response may get fragmented. And that, of course, makes these reflective attacks a lot worse. Because not only do we get more data back, but that data is also fragmented, making it harder to filter the data. And so this, it's a little bit a difficult issue whether or not to enable EDNS 0. You have to if you do DNSSEC. It's required if you do DNSSEC. But the other problem is that a lot of firewalls are not aware that something like EDNS 0 exists, and they just filter all UDP port 53 traffic that's larger than 512 bytes. So actually EDNS 0 fails a lot of the time, and then it causes additional overhead because now I have to go back without EDNS 0. So it's a difficult topic, EDNS 0. I don't have a strict recommendation on what you should do about it. If you do DNSSEC, you don't have a choice. You have to do EDNS 0. It's required. If you don't do DNSSEC, you may consider turning it off on your resolvers, just to avoid some of these, to make these amplification attacks less of a problem. You know, they still exist, but of course with EDNS 0, they can get even worse, and to avoid the firewall issues that you may run into. Okay, how can you tell the difference between a recursive and an authoritative server? An authoritative, it's really a configuration change. And the way to test it is an authoritative server should be listed as an NS record for a particular zone. So you could look that up and you then send a query to that DNS server for that authoritative zone. You should get a response back with the authoritative answer flag set. Now, a recursive name server, what you do is you basically just pick a random host name, yahoo.com, and ask that DNS server for the A record for yahoo.com. If it resolves it for you, it's recursive. If it doesn't, if it responds with a refused answer, that means it's not recursive. Does this answer the question, Gene? Okay, sorry, just had to chase the dog out here. Anyway, DNS caching. So each resource record has a time to live attached to it. That essentially tells your resolver or your client, for that matter, for how long it can cache this record. Clients frequently overwrite that and don't cache it for that long. They sort of have a cutoff time, also some limited amount of memory they set aside for this cache, and then of course the oldest records will time out automatically. So you can't really rely on it being cached for that long, but that's really, it should never be cached for any longer than this time to live. But if it becomes a problem is if your client accepts a spoofed response. In this case, of course, whoever is able to spoof the response typically sets a pretty large time to live, and then you have to manually go in and clear the cache in order to clear out that bad record. But it is a good feature to have the time to live. It does allow you to actually reduce the load on your DNS servers a lot. And how long you set the time to live on your own records that you are authoritative for is really a judgment call. Don't send it too short because that would cause a lot of extra queries on your server. However, if you set it too long, then of course it becomes hard to change the records. Common numbers are sort of half an hour to an hour. Now, when we talk about spoofing, how does the DNS server know that the response it receives is actually coming from the right source? Like we're talking UDP here. The IP address could be spoofed. Now, I mentioned earlier the primary security feature here is the 16-bit query ID. And I won't talk here about all the different attacks, but 64,000 or 65,000 different options here isn't really good enough to reliably prevent someone from just guessing the right query ID. So one feature that was implemented starting a couple of years ago, if you heard about the Kaminsky attack, which sort of brought that to the forefront again as a very feasible attack. Now, what Resolver started it, that they also randomized the source port from which they ask the query. In the old days, and I'm talking here about 2 or 3 years ago, the source port remained to be the same. So the source port never changed. That's to make DNS more efficient, to keep the latency down. That way, the DNS server, when it starts up, it reserves a source port for itself and then keeps reusing it. Now, what most modern DNS servers do is they pick a few thousand, like usually 5,000 is what Windows DNS server does. They pick, essentially, when they start out, they pick 5,000 random ports. The problem with that is nobody else can use on that system those 5,000 ports. If you later start a service that will use one of those ports that the DNS server happened to have reserved, that service no longer can use that port. But this was sort of the workaround to allow the queries, to the responses, to be validated better. And if you assume that we use the full 16-bit source port range, then you have now a total of 32 bits or 4 billion bits to essentially randomize the queries. However, the real answer is, of course, DNSSEC. DNSSEC is what you should implement in order to actually prevent DNS spoofing. Anybody here implemented DNSSEC? Could just raise the hand icon if you implemented DNSSEC. I see it more and more being implemented. Part of it is also FISMA, like if you're working for federal government entity, that requires DNSSEC. However, it isn't an easy thing to implement. Now, the big thing with DNSSEC is that essentially your resolver is able to verify whether or not the data is authentic, all the way back to the authoritative name server that originally delivered the data. So that's really the key for it. It's not like SSL where it just secures a connection, it actually secures the data itself. And it's not encrypting, it's really only about validation. It's only about authentication and making sure that the data didn't get tampered with. So how does it work? Well, DNSSEC is built around public-private key cryptography. The public keys are published via DNS. The private keys should never hit the DNS server itself. So you can keep them offline, you can create your signed zones, and then the keys, the signatures, they're now just additional records in your zone file, like your A records, your addresses, and your name service records. In order to make this process somewhat efficient, there are two different keys that are being used. First of all, you have a zone signing key. That zone signing key is used to create the signatures for each individual record in your zone. The problem with that is DNS servers have to validate them all the time. Like every time you receive a response, you get the signature, you have to get the key, you have to validate whether or not the signature is correct. That's quite a bit of computational overhead. So in order to speed that up, these zone signing keys are kept small. The problem with that, of course, is, well, and now you have to change those zone signing keys frequently because they could be brute forced. In addition to these zone signing keys, you have key signing keys. Those zone signing keys are signed using the key signing keys. So these key signing keys only have to be used if there's a new zone signing key and it has to be validated. DNS servers don't have to do that a lot. So we can keep them large. We don't have to change them a lot. That they're not changing a lot is important because those zone signing keys, they are now validated using your parent zone. So if you are running sans.org, .org would basically tell users or resolvers that your zone signing key is correct. So how does it look like? This is what these key records look like. These are the public keys again. Like I said, the private keys are never added to the zone. Now, there's these flags here. They're either 256 or 257. The important part here is the last bit. If the last bit is set, it basically means that this key is sort of the origin for this particular zone, can be used as an entry point, or is the key signing key. But I got this a little bit wrong here. So highest bit set, that's the key signing key. Zone signing key would be 256. Then you have the protocol, that's always 3 for DNSSEC, and then what algorithm we use. Now, if you looked at all that encryption and encryption problems, usually one of the issues is that people come up with better algorithms all the time, and old algorithms are found to be no longer safe. So there are a number of different algorithms. Don't overdo it. Don't go with the latest and most cutting-edge one, because not all resolvers support all algorithms. So stick with something well-supported. 7 here, the RSA and SHA-1 algorithm is probably the best compromise at this point. Now, how do we actually deposit our key with our parent zone? In order to do that, we create a DS record, or a delegation of signing record. That's just a hash of our public key, and we send that to our parent zone. Usually that'll be your registrar. So, for example, GoDaddy supports that. You tell GoDaddy, these are my DS records, and then they will add them to the .org zone here, in this case, for dshield.org. So now if I want to know whether or not the key that I received from you is correct, I now check with the parent key and retrieve the DS record. With that, I get a key tag. I can calculate that key tag from the key I received from you. You may have multiple keys at any time, and I can then check whether or not this hash is correct, because otherwise I could have spoofed the response that included your key. And this is how you work your way up. So let's look at an example here. Now, what does it look like? I'm now looking up the A record for www.shield.org. I'm getting back the A record, just like normal, and because I asked to use DNSSEC, I set the necessary flags here, I'm also getting the signature back. And the signature here, I'm getting algorithm 7, I'm getting 3 for DNSSEC, I'm getting the original TTL, so this originally started out at 3,600. Each signature has a validity time frame. And this is that's probably the most common issue that people have with DNSSEC. Your signatures will expire. You have to keep re-signing the zone. If you don't do this, then your zone will become invalid. And most DNS admins aren't used to that. So you have to set up a script that goes in once a week, once a month, whatever time frame you set up there, creates new keys and re-signs the zone. You see here, this one will expire August 15th, so in a couple of days. Hopefully everything will be nicely new signed there. And then you have your signature here, plus again the key ID that was used to actually create that signature. I abbreviated signature to make it fit on the slide better, and well, it's just a base 64 encoded string here. So I get the A record just like before. If I don't care about DNSSEC, I will just ignore the rest, and then I get the signature. Now next I need the keys. So I would retrieve the keys for the shield.org. What I'm getting back are the keys. I'm getting a key signing key and a zone signing key here. Then I will calculate the key tag from these keys. They're not part of the record. I have to calculate them from the key itself and then check which key was used to create that signature. And then I can validate it. You see here we have the key tag for that particular key. So I know then what key to use. Next thing I have to make sure is this key valid? Well, and then I have to retrieve the DS record for the shield.org. I have to go to the .org name server in order to get them. And here are the two the shield.org DS records. And again, they have the signature, sorry, the algorithm that will be used, 7, and then the hashing algorithm for this particular key. The most common options here are SHA-1 and SHA-256. There are a couple others. They're not that widely used. Now, another problem you have with DNSSEC is that how do you prove that something doesn't exist? How do we essentially assign the fact that some name doesn't exist? How do we sign nothing? The workaround for that are these NSEC records. With each response, I can ask for an NSEC record. The NSEC record tells me what's the next response. And then that NSEC record is signed. So with that, I know that the response was valid because I can check whether that signature was valid. Now, NSEC is the next secure entry in your zone file. The original way was just basically clear text, the next host name. Now, what people started doing then was they did zone transfers via NSEC records. I just asked you for a random host name. I asked you for the NSEC record for that random host name. It tells me the next host name. And now I can ask for the next secure record for that host name and sort of work my way through. In response to that, what you should do these days is NSEC 3, which instead of just listing the host name itself, it lists a hash of the host name, so it can no longer be used to enumerate host names. Now, is there an easy way to figure out how it all works? If you experiment with DNSSEC, I highly recommend you look at dnsvis.net. It's a website operated by Sandia National Lab, and it will go out, do all this magic for you, and then nicely and graphically represent it. I did it here for the shield. So it shows you here, okay, we have the shield.org. There's one key currently being used. There's a zone signing key that signs this key. There are two other keys, but they're not currently used. And that's very typical. You typically keep the last key that you used and the next key sort of in your zone, so when you rotate, hosts will already have those keys available. And then you see sort of these errors here. It goes up, and I broke it up in a couple of slides to make it easier to see. That's now our .org zone, and our .org zone holds two DS records. If you go just back here, you know, these are these two keys. We have DS records for them in the .org zone, and then those DS records themselves are signed with keys for the .org zone. The .org zone has its own key signing key that is then assigned by the root zone. So this slide will very easily allow you to check for errors and such, and things that aren't quite set up, aren't quite working right. Like there's actually here these red errors indicate that there is an error here. The error was that one of the .org name servers did not include this particular key, which sometimes happens during key rotation. Okay, so how do you implement it? How do you turn it on? On the resolver, it's pretty easy. You install the key for the root zone as a trusted key. Now, later versions of Bind have a managed keys feature. You only have to do it once, and Bind will automatically update that key for you. So that's pretty easy on the resolver. All you have to do is turn it on. On the authoritative name server, it's more tricky. First, you have to sign your zones, and don't forget to continuously re-sign them as your signatures expire. Then you have to upload DBS records, and they're created as part of signatures. The signature scripts typically create these DBS records for you as they create the keys. So you have to upload them to your registrar, and then you're all ready to go and set. Now, another thing you have is there are a couple plugins for browsers that will do it for you. I have here in Chrome, it sort of has this little key here. I just tried a couple presidential candidates here. Neither one of the big ones actually implements DNSSEC on their website. Here, my doc's presidential website does DNSSEC. That's, I think, the only presidential candidate right now that does DNSSEC. But like I said, FISMA requires it, so all .gov domains should use DNSSEC. These here, of course, are .com domains, so FISMA doesn't really apply to that. So I didn't find a document was badly signed. Right now, but you should see a red key there. And this plugin is available for Firefox and Chrome. I'm not aware of anything for Safari or for Internet Explorer, but there may be something out there. And if you install this plugin, then the browser itself will actually do the validation. So it will not necessarily rely on the recursive name server for it. Okay, now OpenDNS. OpenDNS, initially it was sort of set up as kind of a cheap man's kind of URL blocking, great for home users, great for small businesses. However, because they kind of play man in the middle on DNS, they cannot do DNSSEC. So if you use OpenDNS, DNSSEC will not work for you. Now, I believe OpenDNS does its own DNSSEC validation. Yeah, but if you install like this plugin in your client and you use OpenDNS, or if you use your own name server but forward requests to OpenDNS, then DNSSEC will fail and will basically come back as invalid. OpenDNS came up with its own scheme, DNSScript. Now, DNSScript is really not a replacement for DNSSEC. The only thing that DNSScript does is it protects the connection from your client to the OpenDNS DNS server. So if OpenDNS validates DNSSEC, then you can use DNSScript sort of for that last mile kind of verification. Now, DNSScript also encrypts DNS. So, for example, if you use an open wireless access point with DNSScript, people can no longer sniff your DNS queries. So it has a very different focus, really, than DNSSEC. It's not a replacement. Another encryption algorithm you have for DNS is TSIC. Now, that's an older one. It essentially relies on shared secrets. The way this is typically used is if you have multiple authoritative name servers for your zone and you do zone transfers between them, you install TSIC. So you basically exchange secrets with those name servers, and now they can use TSIC to authenticate queries and encrypt them. TSIC, in order to prevent replay attacks, just like Kerberos and similar protocols, will include the timestamp. So with that, you are now actually, you have to make sure that your times are in sync, or otherwise DNS replication and such will fail. Great thing to do for replication, but really not applicable for clients, because you have to essentially exchange these secret keys between all of the participants. Another sort of hack more that some people have implemented is, whenever you get the response back from the name server, it includes the query that you originally asked. And what some people do is that they use basically a random capitalization. Host names are not case sensitive, So if I ask for uppercase Google or lowercase Google, or if I do a mixed case Google, I still get the same response back. And then I can use essentially the upper lowercase pattern that I imprinted on the host name to validate whether or not the response is real. Now, sounds like a great idea, but not all name servers maintain the case. There are some name servers that will just convert all to lower or all uppercase. So it has limited applications, really. And I do still see it around. I do see the queries. So if you see one of these mixed case queries, there's nothing really bad about them. Just someone using this OX20, and that's just the bit that essentially, you know, is lower and uppercase that encoding. Anyway, a quick summary here before we run out of time. Probably the most important thing to start with DNS is don't publish stuff in DNS that you don't want people to know about. I mentioned zone transfers, you definitely want to protect them, but people could just brute force. There are tools out there that will just essentially try dictionary words, dot your domain, and see if they resolve or don't resolve. So only publish data in your authoritative name server that you actually want to be published. And then set up dedicated authoritative and recursive servers. You may also do something that's usually referred to as split DNS. So you have two authoritative name servers, one that answers queries that come from inside your name, your network, and then maybe, for example, let's say you have the development website. The development website only really has to resolve to inside your network. So the public really doesn't have to know that there is a dev.sans.org. So that's where this split DNS comes in handy. You can use the same DNS server for that if you want to. Use DNSSEC if possible, but be aware there is a chance that you'll break things and that DNS will become unresponsive. Open DNS, DNS script, nice ideas, but like I said, specific use cases. If you use unprotected wireless networks, if you're afraid of sniffing, DNS script is a great thing to do. Open DNS, great for home users, great for small businesses. I would not call it an enterprise solution, even though for pay now they have enterprise solutions that give you more granular logging and blocking and things like that. So can take a look at that. And they're not expensive, so it's still a pretty cheap way to do a quick malicious domain protection. And then definitely watch your DNS logs. There's lots of interesting stuff that you can learn from your DNS logs. And what did I not have time for? Multicast DNS. Actually, just recently did a little sort of 10-minute video about multicast DNS. You can find that on the IPv6, on the ISC website. IPv6, that's also sort of part of multicast DNS and DNS. Very special records like CNAME, DNAME, and such. Using DNS for covert channels. You can do file transfers over DNS. And then DNS syncholes, you know, doing malware prevention and detection via DNS. I find that very, very useful, but it's almost sort of a webcast for itself. With that, do we have any more questions? And let me turn the chat on for everybody. A couple additional people joined. Like I said, we are recording that, so there will be an archive for this webcast. If you go to sans.org/webcast, there's a link to all the old archived webcasts. Typically it takes them a couple hours to move them live, so if you missed part of the beginning, if you join later, you can catch up with that. It uses the same Illuminate interface. You'll see everything, including questions and such. Well, if you don't have any more questions, then thanks again for listening. And the email addresses are here. If you have any additional questions later, or if you listen to this recording, just use the email address. Thanks, and talk to you again in a month, or if you're listening to the daily podcast, well, maybe tomorrow morning.